Welcome everybody, good afternoon. Thanks for your patience, it's been one of those days. Weather conditions in London have been quite appalling, so we're absolutely delighted that Professor Danny Doherty is actually here with us in person. Very slight delay to today's programme. And we're absolutely delighted to have him in our programme. I'm sure you're very well aware of his work and his bio. He's a professor of geography, University of Oxford. Very widely published writer, commentator, and of course, on this particular topic, I think he will shed a very interesting perspective in terms of what prompted so many people to vote for Brexit and the underlying sort of reasons that underpinned that stimulus. So, without further ado, please welcome Professor Doherty to our stage.
Thank you very much for coming. I'm probably only going to talk for about 35 minutes, and then hopefully we're going to spend some time talking together and I'm going to learn something. Because I don't learn anything from this except for my own body. Yeah. I've only written one thing on Brexit so far, because Brexit's nice and complicated. I wrote an editorial a couple of weeks after the vote for the British Medical Journal, which might sound arthritis to a British medical journal, but Brexit affects so many things, and one of them is probably medicine and public health in Britain. It's rather hard to staff hospitals in certain parts of the country already, possibly as a result of Brexit. But we'll find out in the next few months, the next few years, a lot of these things. I've got a question for you before I go any further. Did anybody here not vote in the referendum? Great.
Because I'm a Greek national voter.
So you couldn't vote, okay. Is there anybody here who could vote who didn't vote? No? Okay, so we've already got a biased audience. Right, so about 1 in 4, 1 in 3 people didn't bother to vote. I was going to make whoever didn't vote ask a question first at the end to kind of undo the bias, but you've got to remember that, although this is probably important to me, and it's important to you, you've turned up on St. Patrick's Day for this, it's not important to a lot of people still. It will become important, I suspect, but it isn't that important. I'm going to show you a few things. The slides are really a kind of just a prop so that I don't have to look at you looking at me, you'll look at them. I won't explain them all, we can always go back to them. But I'm going to suggest that Brexit has taught us a lot that we didn't know. Not the marginal nature of the vote. If we'd been a little bit more imaginative before the vote, we would have realised it was close. Perhaps it taught us that we were a little bit too self-assured and we believed spread betting too much. The spread betting said it's not going to happen. Turns out the spread betting was wrong. What Brexit has taught us, I think, was beginning to teach us about ourselves, is that we were much more unsure than we thought we were as a country. And it's the map. I'm a geographer, it's the map I get this from. The map of the vote, which I'll show you in a few slides' time, is the most remarkable map of Britain. It's remarkable because there is no other map like it. Maps of voting, maps of how people do at school, maps of how people die, maps of how much house prices cost, all these maps, they all look the same. I can claim with some confidence I have drawn more maps of the United Kingdom and its social geography than anybody else who's alive today. I am sick of drawing maps. I've drawn many tens and tens of thousands of maps of Britain. They all begin to look the same. And then we got this map, and this map was different. Go on.
Could I ask you to speak a little closer to the mic?
I can, thank you. Is that better?
Yeah, thank
okay.
You.
It takes time to work out. When something actually new happens, possibly new happens, it takes time to adjust to it. You don't immediately adjust to it. UK is a very unequal country. I try not to say it too much. But by the Gini coefficient, we are the most economically unequal country by income of all OECD countries in Europe. Occasionally Latvia beats us for 1 year and then we beat it again. Occasionally Estonia is more unequal for 1 year and then we beat it again. But basically, we are incredibly unequal. More unequal. Europe's full of countries. It's quite an effort to be the most unequal. There's loads of little ones as well, but we still manage the UK to be more unequal than all of them. And I just have a feeling that that has had an effect. This is the north of England and Scotland. It's coloured by the ethnicity of people aged 16 to 24. And there's just quite a few colours there. I just want to show you that to say that the north, Manchester, Liverpool, don't worry, the maps are strange. When it matters, I'm trying to explain them more. There's a lot of colour there, basically. And the areas that are blue, which are where white British stroke white Irish are the most common ethnic minority groups, or majority groups. They're the biggest, but they don't dominate. South of England is less cosmopolitan. You might not have thought that. If you go into London, it's a bit more interesting. You go to Birmingham, it's interesting, but the bulk of the south of England and Wales, even for young people, pretty white, not much immigration historically. There's been loads and loads of analysis. One of the best predictors of voting to leave is that the fewer immigrants in your area, the more likely you were to vote to leave. This is an analysis some people did very shortly after the vote. It's people with very complicated names. Maria Cortina Borgia, Julian Stander, and Luciana Dalla Bella. What they're plotting here is the proportion of people who've got unique names in an area, a bit like their names. That's an indicator of immigration, when people got unique names. And the proportion who voted to leave on the other side, for England, Scotland and Wales. For some reason they left out Northern Ireland, which is often done. And basically, the fewer people with unique names, the less immigration, the more people were likely to vote for leave. Now, of course, it isn't that people looked around and said, there's no immigrants here, we've got to leave the European community because there are no immigrants. You know, in some ways, when you poll people, you got the opposite. People said the problem was immigration. But not when there are actually people near you. Here's the graph that we never draw in the United Kingdom. We never draw a graph celebrating immigration. It's the kind of thing you see in the United States. Have whole museums in the United States to celebrate immigration. This is an attempt from every census from 1841 to work out who's living in the country and where they came from. And you might look at the end of that and go, oh, look, it's going up a lot. But I'll show you in a minute, it isn't going up a lot. Just depends how you draw the graph. But that last bit is just people are moving around the world further than before. The same thing's happening everywhere. And we've worried about immigration before. But we've tended to worry about immigration when we've been worrying about other things politically. Immigration's a really useful scapegoat. When you don't want people to look at you, if you're taking from them what they need, the ability to educate their children, the ability to house themselves well, and so on, if it's actually you doing that. Supposing I was deciding to take away budgets from your children's schools. I was going to make it harder for them to start a family and get a house. I was going to reduce the amount of money that was going to your healthcare system so that you're going to die earlier. Mortality has risen in the UK in the last few weeks. Infant mortality has risen in the last 2 years for the first time since, I reckon, 1905. Supposing I was going to do all those things, not because I was a completely psychopathic person and wanted to kill people, but because I had some belief that the free market is wonderful and you just got to go through a bit of pain before you get there. I'm not going to tell you the free market's wonderful and you're going to go through a little bit of pain before we're going to get there, comrades. I'm going to tell you that all the things that are bad in this country are due to immigrants, and get on with my programme. And if you want a kind of potted history of the last 20 years of British politics, in some ways, it's been that. I won't say anything else about 1890s, 1905. Just to remember, we've been here before with the immigration thing. That's the same graph drawn a different way. But you can worry about immigrants as much as you like. One of the really interesting things about Brexit so far is the lack of anger from people who've been most affected. Lack of expressed anger. It is absolutely stunning, the quietness so far. The people most affected immediately are the people who do not have UK citizenship living in the UK, and the people living elsewhere in Europe on the mainland who do not have citizenship. The anger and hurt and sadness and fear is absolutely enormous when you talk to people. The sadness of people when their children come home from school, where I live in Oxford, and ask their parents whether they're able to stay. And their parents say, oh, we'll probably be able to stay. And they say, can my friend stay? And their friend, because their parent isn't doing as well paid job and doesn't have a British passport, might not be able to stay at their school. I mean, I won't go on about this, but you get the sense. What's incredible is the quietness about that. And I wonder, I'm too young. I'm 50. I was a child in the 70s. Few of you are older than me. Can you remember when the National Front first started telling people from the Caribbean to go back to Africa? Were they quiet at first, before people got really angry about racists? Just a question to think about. Go back home, go back where you come from, because you're not like us, you don't fit in. I think we need to say more about that. European-wide map of immigration rates. These maps are all stretched so you can see where people are. Normal maps hide people. The colours are the proportion of people born in another country living in that place. Dark blue is 20% or more. Medium blue is 15 to 20. The area, I don't know if the mouse will come up. Nope, it's on my screen, not yours. The area in the middle of Europe with high immigration is Switzerland. London is where we have 20% plus, which of course votes remain. Ireland, all of Ireland, relatively high immigration rates, partly because of the border, but not only because of the border. Next in Europe, you have to go down to Spain. Madrid's quite high, that's the big circle in the middle. But then there's that sliver along the coast, full of immigrants, what we call them expats. And that's part of the group who are affected. But most of Europe is that yellow colour, which is less than 5%. People were born in another country or living where you're living. And you'll see most of England is like that, less than 5%. Here's that map, this amazing map of the vote. There's two maps. One is in which area, who got the majority, people remain, and the other is the proportion. Now the proportions, everybody concentrates on relatively poor towns on the east coast of England and says, oh, look at the anger there about immigration. They don't matter. There are too few such towns. The votes of the people there, votes of people up in Sunderland, they didn't swing it. 59% of the Leave votes in the United Kingdom were people in social class A, B and C1, middle class, because middle class people vote, and we've got a big middle class. 60% of the votes to leave from the whole of the UK were from the south of England. These really simple facts, people don't want you to remember them, to know them. This is what the stupid, thick, poor northerners did. No, it's not. This is what Middle England quietly did. And then for some reason, the story wasn't told. There were all kinds of oddities in the maps. Liverpool and Manchester, voting majority remain, and you can begin to make up stories to fit this, but I will resist that, resist doing it. And of course, Scotland and Northern Ireland have different reasons for having voted differently. So what's going on? I mean, we've learnt an enormous amount already. I think one thing we've learned is that it's very unlikely that another European country is going to try to leave after this. Because it turns out it's not quite so easy to leave. Turns out if you've got a border, even a border you'd forgotten about, because you know, it wasn't important because you're English. If you've got any kind of border at all, that really is it. You're not leaving. It took Greenland, Greenland's the only other part of the community that's ever left, with 56,000 people, not 64 million. It took Greenland 3 years to negotiate, and Greenland's got fish that are worth negotiating over. I'll try not to get too sceptical, but you can see the images up there. Um, the United Kingdom, well, if it's lost wars, it's never known it's lost a war. Very, very strange place. Most of the world, people have got relatively recent experience of being invaded, of being together. In the United Kingdom, I say we, but we're very divided, so we doesn't mean very much. But we have a fabricated history that we told ourselves. I was taught geography as a school child, in which I was told to learn where all the resources of the world came from so we could go out and get them, because we are highly qualified to do that and govern other people as well at the same kind of time. Other people in other countries don't get told this kind of history, don't get taught about their national superiority. One thing I want to suggest is that in the last few decades, as say the pounds has fallen, I can remember getting 10 francs of the pound as a school child, first time I ever went abroad, I went to France. 10 francs of the pound. We were rich. And as that changes, you begin to think, well, something's gone wrong. I mean, first of all, it was the trade unions, terrible trade unions in the 1970s. They were really bad, they mucked things up. And then it was the immigrants, then it's Margaret Thatcher, then it's Tony Blair, then it's Iraq. Something always goes wrong. What we never quite got is that the reason we were so rich wasn't because we made wonderful ships on the docks here, or we invented the spinning jelly, or all those things. We had the world's biggest empire. And then we lost the world's biggest empire. The profit and income we made from having an empire went. But because we never told ourselves that we actually benefited from having the empire, it was just our burden, we were doing it as a favour to the planet. We never accepted it. Well, it is, you step back and look at it. But I don't want to be, I should get this cynical notion out of my, but this is what I was taught at school. Implicitly, through between the lines of the textbooks, that we should be great, the greatest place, and something must be holding us back if we're not. Let's just look at the vote for a little bit. There is no settled view. The vote goes up and down, there is no settled view of the British people. It isn't that there's a group of people who've held a great love of the European Union for decades and decades, and they get the chance to express their great love, and enough that people have known it's entirely wrong, and we need our sovereignty, and we need our country, or countries, whatever they are, back. It just goes all over the place. There's your graph. A couple of years after the great banking crisis, the beginnings of the biggest austerity since the Second World War, possibly bigger now, you've got the majority leave. So you don't call a referendum. But as things settled down, that green line's going down, the blue line's rising up, and you've got a very split Conservative Party, and you're sitting there and you're feeling really confident. Really, really confident. Everything's gone well in your life. You passed your A-levels. You got that place at Brasenose. The job, the PR job in the city worked out for you. You became an MP. You went and hugged some huskies. That's one of the best Prime Ministers we've ever seen. And then you go and win an election outright you never expected to win in 2015, and you're G'd up, and you call a referendum. Because your advisors say, we can win this one, apart from George, and George said, don't do it, Dave, whatever you do, don't do it. You don't listen to George, because he's always been a bit annoying from the lesser school. And you call it, and then the two lines begin to merge. And the question is partly, why did the two lines merge? How did they merge? Who got them to merge? Because one way in which this vote has been interpreted is just you're all sitting here slowly making up your minds with well-informed information. But that isn't entirely what went on. There were some other people who wanted you to make decisions in particular ways. Then you may think that you're completely immune to that and you're all highly able to decide for yourselves your views and how you vote. But look. Look at the line wiggling up and down. It isn't that there's been a slow movement of the population one way or the other. They go all over the place. Now, here's a complicated graph. I apologise for this being complicated. But it's along the y-axis going up and down if you're into your graphs is the proportion of people in the UK supporting far-right parties. I put them all together National Front, Referendum Party, BNP, English Democrats, and UKIP. And then along the x-axis, you've got how fast is the change in support for those parties moving. Right at the beginning, you went to see, we've got 1997, Jimmy Goldsmith's Referendum Party. He threw loads of money at it, an enormous amount of money, managed to get himself about 1.5% of the vote. You may have forgotten the Referendum Party, but it's really key now when you're trying to understand why we had a referendum. This thing skittles around at 1-2% of the vote, but every time you're heading towards a European election, 2009, it goes up, down again. Another European election, 2014, goes right up to 14% of the vote. It's now currently at less than 1%. UKIP are doing us an incredible favour. The lust of old men for younger women is wonderful. UKIP are currently, by being disastrous, helping show that you really are back to 1% of people who call, well, you know, give me a far-right party on the ballot and I will take it. It's only 1% of the population will do that. The rest of us have to be G'd up to vote for people like that. And we can be. And that thing is showing it G'd up for elections, but the referendum was a giant G'ing up that occurred. Why is Britain strange? Anywhere, Rome 2,000 years ago, the United States now, Russia before 89, the Ottoman Empire, Venice a bit earlier, we can try and guess. Anywhere that is at the centre of an empire is a strange place. You begin to believe strange beliefs. Now add on to that this coincidence. In 1859, a couple of decades before the empire had become the strongest it was going to be ever, in 1859, somebody comes out with a book, quite slowly and carefully, called The Origin of Species, with a subtitle everybody forgets about the favoured races. That's his family tree, by the way. It's incredibly interbred. Saying that, in fact, it wasn't that God necessarily put us where we are, but we might have evolved to be what we are, and stronger things evolve to do better, and weaker things don't. And there you are, sitting in England, at the time when somebody says about this. And what do you think? Well, especially if you're male, it's easier if you're male. If you're female, it's harder to imagine doing this, but if you're male, it's really easy. You think, well, I'm special. My father's special, my grandfather's special. That's why we're so rich. It's not that we did something wrong, it's because we rose to the top through our special abilities. We invented those spinning jennies. You know, we make wonderful ships that the world wants to buy until it gets a choice. And you tell yourself, and you tell your children, and you don't necessarily do it explicitly, although Beveridge wrote a book with advice for women, telling them they should, if they're middle class, have four children for the good of the race. That's William Beveridge. This kind of stuff is embedded in us. The other thing which is embedded in us, or in particular ones of us, I don't know if anybody wants to volunteer about their off-seas wealth holdings, is that some of us have a lot of money held in small islands around the world that we really want to leave there, or use occasionally, but we don't want it to be touched. And the European Union is a threat to us. Quite a lot of us, at least older than me, actually grew up in colonies. Grew up in colonies with servants who were not the same colour as us in terms of skin. It's amazing once you start going through Brexit, how many of the leading older Brexiteers actually grew up somewhere where they were a caste apart. This is what I mean about learning about ourselves. I mean, you can see I am guessing here. But I couldn't have begun to try to tell a story like this before that referendum result. It wouldn't have made any sense. It wouldn't have been quite so clear as it's beginning to become clear now. Let's just go through four men. It's always remarkable men. There's 100 books on Brexit out now. Finally, one has got one woman as an author. Early on, they were all Oxford and Cambridge as well, graduates writing on them. Anyway, there's James Goldsmith. He died shortly after that, but Zach is very proud of what he did in the referendum party. Why was James so interested in getting us out of Europe? What was James trying to protect? Why does it matter to James? There's Nigel. Nigel from Dulwich, and into the city. What is it that drives Nigel? I'm not saying this isn't about conspiracy theory, it's just these people mattered. These people have been trying to get people to behave like this for many, many years. More recently, and you may not know, Dominic Cummings was the campaign director of Vote Leave. Before then, he was a spad for Michael Gove. He produced his kind of PhD, it wasn't a PhD, but he wrote one anyway. Put it up on the web, saying that the 1% richest people in the world deserve to be the richest because they were also genetically the cleverest and they inherited that from their parents. That's Dominic, campaign director for Vote Leave. And that's the kind of things Dominic believes in. Minorish, maybe we should call it medium, private school north of England. Background, Dulwich College for Nigel. And the chief executive, Matthew Elliott. I didn't deliberately pick that photo. All his photos have been looking rather pleased with himself. Matthew Elliott used to work for the Taxpayers Alliance. Taxpayers Alliance is a wonderful organisation. How many of you are taxpayers? You all are VAT on goods, right? Taxpayers Alliance, they're for us to look after our interests as taxpayers. Of course they're not. Taxpayers Alliance, they won't say who they're funded by, but the suspicion is they're funded by people who don't pay tax. What had to possess you as a young man? Again, medium, minor, private school, north of England background, drawing too many dots. Think, you know, I'm going to work for people who've got lots of money and don't want to pay tax, that'll really help. But that's what drove Matthew for a time before he became the chief executive of Vote Leave. The official ratio of spending, by the way, as reported to the Electoral Commission, Leave, 52% of all spending, Remain, 48%. Well, it's coincidence, but it's quite incredible. That's the official spending. The DUP do wonderful things here just to make it look even nicer so that, you know, it'd be terrible for me if everything was squeaky clean with money moving through this place. But of course the tabloids, all the tabloid news stories, that wasn't official spending. Years of Daily Mail telling you how terrible immigrants are wasn't official spending. And to be fair to the other side, David Cameron campaigning for Remain wasn't counted as official spending, although I would say David is not that charismatic a person. Couple more graphs. This is just England, because where are we going to get to who voted? There's been surveys. The problem with surveys is they're surveys, so lots of people don't fill them in. The best survey we have is the exit poll. The exit poll was financed by Lord Ashcroft, who grew up in a series of colonies with a nanny who was different to him. Lord Ashcroft wanted us to leave. Lord Ashcroft paid for a very large exit survey. This is literally 6 seconds after putting your cross, you walk out, and somebody on behalf of Lord Ashcroft asks you how you vote. They don't say on behalf of Lord Ashcroft, but other than that, it's how do you vote. Lord Ashcroft funded a very large exit survey because he assumed that they weren't going to win this time. They'd have to get another referendum to leave. And so he wanted to produce lots of data about how robbed people had been. The Ashcroft survey is pretty good, and the raw results are pretty good. This is just showing you constituencies. English constituencies grouped into 10 groups. The one which is slightly higher has a number 3 because they don't divide by 10. And that's the poshest areas, the areas of the least deprivation. And they're almost all blue. Okay? A couple are orange. That'll be Sheffield Hallam, I don't know the other one. Probably somewhere in Hampstead is Labour, but on that first column, those are the really well-off parts of England. They vote Conservative. The next tenth, the next tenth, the next tenth, the next tenth, till you get to the bottom 4/10. And they're red. Because people have had a long time in England to work out where they stand. And most people have worked out, if you live in somewhere where there's quite a lot of poverty, the Conservative Party aren't going to look after your interests and don't care about you. That's why all the poor areas are red. and this is the other way around. Right, so there's a lot of pattern in there. By deprivation. Now, that's the Brexit vote. Exactly the same areas. No pattern. You do have, in the areas of the least deprivation, absolute solid Remain. Hence the BBC was shocked, because this is where you live if you work for the BBC in London. Hence I was shocked. I don't actually live, Oxford East isn't one of those, but I live near enough to it. That's the elite of Britain. They live in the richest areas, everybody votes Remain. But you go across and the purples, dark purple is big Leave, light purple is marginal Leave, and there's a lot of purple. But look at the poorest 40% of the country, and it's a little bit more yellow. It's the middle constituencies. It's basically poor Tories. That's the easiest way I can describe it. People who are most likely to vote to leave in England were living in constituencies that voted Tory, but they were not the poshest Tory areas. And these constituencies were mostly in the south of England, and they were doing fine, because a poor Tory area is hardly poor. It doesn't look like deprivation. I went to Tewkesbury. Right, Tewkesbury's got an abbey. It's all quite pretty, except there's a pound land on the high street, and there's two pile on the high street. And if you spend 10 hours in Tewkesbury, you can spot two people who are not white. Tewkesbury voted to leave. That red line at the top is the take of the 1%. It's faltering now, but they were taking more and more and more. This is public spending in a series of countries. The UK is that big thick line. You can see it heading down. Ireland, by the way, is fascinating. Ireland followed George Osborne's advice over what it should do with banks. It's terrible, terrible advice. But the UK, really bad for public spending. NHS is massively underfunded. Our state schools are underfunded. Our levels of poverty are some of the worst in Western Europe. It's not a happy place. I'm going to skip through. If anybody wants to have an argument about Empire 2.0, we can, but let's just say the trade data kind of does show who we actually really trade with. Latest trade data, 2016. Financial Times has been pointing out how odd the UK was. This is kind of explaining what's gone on. You know, in a country which was getting richer, GDP was rising, but average wages were falling because you're the most unequal country in Europe. You get a tiny bit of recovery, and they can't even be bothered to give you a bit of it. Because, you know, no wonder people were annoyed. But their annoyance was not focused on the people who were doing this, who were making the country so unequal. Their annoyance was focused on what they were told the problem was by the environment out there, by the people who were receiving millions of pounds to tell a particular story. Manufacturing disappearing. Manufacturing higher in other countries. I mean, you never know. We could drop the pound right down. Carry on dropping it down. There must be some point at which the pound is so incredibly low that we can manufacture something that sells. I don't want to get cynical. I thought until a week ago that we were the second biggest arms trader in the world, because the UK government says we're the second biggest arms trader in the world. And I said this on Radio 3 at 10 o'clock at night, and somebody emailed me the actual statistics. We're only the sixth biggest arms trader in the world. I didn't feel a great sadness at this point. I'm not particularly proud of being the second biggest arms trader in the world. But the idea of Empire 2.0, The awakening that's going to come is going to be tricky. This slide was produced a few months ago. It's the reports we now know didn't exist, or at least we're told don't exist. There must be something they wrote. Within days of the Brexit vote, by the way, do any of you work in the civil service? No? Okay, you're not going to admit. Good civil servants do not put their hand up and say, I work in the civil service. I don't know if the call, I'd love to know if the call came around here, but it's like in England. Emergency call to civil servants allowing you to instantly transfer to the new units to deal with Brexit. They need to slap them. Now, if you do work in the civil service, you know that you're actually assessed four times a year. And you kind of get one, two, and a three. One is superhuman, two everybody gets. And if you really, really are a bit flaky, you get a three. And if you get a load of threes, you might be in trouble. Who do you think took up the option to move out of their department into the Brexit unit? Anyway. So that might explain why the reports weren't written. You know, you put all the civil servants together who were a bit worried about their job. Anyway. This is from Standard & Poor's. 2016. Which countries are going to be most affected apart from the UK? You can't read, but it says Ireland. Then Malta. Luxembourg. Going to be a bit harder for Luxembourg to do its dodgy money stuff. If London isn't so well connected. Cyprus, Switzerland, Belgium. Standard & Poor's knew immediately. I have to say, having sat in Heathrow for 3 hours and quite amazing I've got here, I kind of don't feel we're in a customs union as it is at the moment. Anyway, I won't say more about that. Particularly free movement of labour. Let's bring it to conclusion, so start thinking of questions. This is a map produced in 1992 on the behalf of Freddie Heineken. It's called the Heineken Map of Europe. And it's a suggestion about what might happen to the European Union in future. And Freddie, who was Liberal Conservative, and made the beer, Freddie thought there's a problem in Europe. You've got these big countries, Germany, France, Spain, Italy, and the UK, and they dominate a bit. So wouldn't it be good if we split them up into smaller countries? And he actually hired a couple of historians to suggest how to do this. Remember, this is way back in 92. And he suggested that Scotland should be on its own, Ireland should be united, and the ones that nobody ever talks about, which is, well, what would you do in England? So I thought I'd put up the Heineken map just to begin to end. There it is across Europe. Interestingly, they got Yugoslavia largely right. So where the changes have begun to happen, they got them right. I'm not saying this is going to happen or not, I'm just saying here's something to look at, something that we haven't really known about. He was kidnapped in 83. I'm not sure if a ransom was paid for him. But that's his map. Last couple of things, so please do think of questions. I showed you that graph of far-right voting before. This is exactly the same graph, but it's voting for the Labour Party. And I'll describe it, you just have to trust me that honestly this is what the graph looks like. Voting for the Labour Party, around about May 2015, you remember Ed Miliband? On the polls, they were getting about 33% of the vote. The polls, by the way, are spot on. You've just got to average them, all of them over a month. So each dot here, apart from the last one, is averaged over a month. And you've got to realise that if I ask you, how would you vote if there's an election tomorrow, you don't know, because it's tomorrow. The answer you actually give if I ask you, how do you vote if there's an election tomorrow, is how you would have voted 6 weeks ago. So the polls tend to lag by 6 weeks. Anyway, 33% of 2015. So Skedaddle's around the place, they have a leadership election, then they have to have another leadership election because you can't have that kind of leader. He goes and wins again. Plummeting down, all your MPs walk out and say, this is terrible, you know, go and fall on your sword, Jeremy, you're terrible, we can't have you. Plummets down and down and down to 26% of people saying they'd vote Labour. Your careful Theresa May, not like that brash David who doesn't know what he's doing and made all his mistakes. Careful Theresa, your officials tell you nobody in the history of British politics has ever lost an election from this point. You would be completely negligent not to call an election now. You go walking, everybody tells you to call an election. You call an election, despite the fact you're ever so careful. And then bang, see that curve? That's the only curve we've ever seen like that. It's never happened before. That curve is a 6% rise in Labour vote in May, and by the 1st of June, just as fast. I finally got brave enough to put a blog up one day before the election saying something quite incredible has happened and the Conservatives might not get the majority, but I was too timid to do anything else of it. The biggest swing in the history of voting in Britain happened last year. But so what? So much has happened that we don't notice the biggest things anymore. It's bigger than the 1945 swing, because the 45 swing happened over 10 years, not two. People are much more flexible, at least have been, than we give them credit for. Let's put up, this is the last slide, just a slightly depressing poster about where we were 100 years ago. So we do kind of forget part of the reason why we have a European Union. Memories aren't that good. So to sum up, I think we're learning a lot about ourselves. We're learning how little a government in London really knows, cares, understands. We're learning how we can be manipulated as an electorate. I think the electorate were manipulated. Europe, mainland, is learning that they have far more in common with each other than they thought. The reasons for solidarity are actually stronger. If you can't actually exit, as is appearing obvious, if you've got any substantial border you care about, you really do have to get on better. So you do need a democratic European Union. We didn't actually have a Conservative Party. We thought we had a Conservative Party. Our Conservative Party was allied to the Polish Law and Justice Party in the European Parliament. Our main party was actually a far-right party. I don't put it in the grass as such, but suddenly, the British Conservative Party is no longer sending MEPs, or won't be, to Brussels. This is incredibly good news for Brussels. Without us, there, on the sidelines, backed up by Hungary and Poland and whoever else is creating trouble, think what Europe can do. Think what kind of rights and solidarity is possible that might not happen if all these people hadn't voted to leave. I mean, it's quite possible that something very special will be happening in the next few years in this continent. It just isn't going to be something that we're going to be part of for a bit. That is my view. And the very last thing I'll say is that I've always been against the monarchy all my life. I wrote an article this week, it may get published before the royal wedding, saying thank God for the British monarchy. Because once we leave, maybe Christmas, maybe the 29th of March next year, it's not going to be our banks that are going to save us. And it's not going to be our amazing new exports of manufacturers, and it's not going to be selling our universities to the best around the world, because you can't do that forever. What's going to keep Britain going for a bit is the cheap pound and the amazing royal family. You couldn't make it up. We needed an American princess right now. We're getting an American princess. It may sound right to you, but being realistic, when you're trying to work out how can we keep paying the housing benefits, how can we do this or that, if you can come up with a better answer for me than the royal family, we're actually going to need the royal family for a bit. But then, if we learn from this, and if when we don't get Empire 2.0, people don't say, oh, it was people like you, Danny. If you just got behind Empire 2.0, it would have worked. Right? If we don't have that, this could finally be Britain, or parts of Britain that haven't learned yet, because other parts have learned better. This could finally be Britain getting out of its empire mentality and becoming a normal European country. And we can thank Nigel Farage for helping us do it. Yeah. Please put your hands up and think of any questions you've got, anything at all. Thank you very much. Why can't the Labour Party stop it? Only one person can possibly stop it, which is Theresa. Theresa can send a letter at any time. That letter may be rejected, legally we don't know. But she can send a letter revoking Article 50. She can then walk into the House of Commons and say, sack me. Theresa's never won anything in her life. She didn't win that election. She didn't win the leadership election, because there wasn't a leadership election. Right? She was given a seat just to the east of Oxford that nobody could ever lose for Conservatives. So Theresa could, for once in her life, do something she'd be remembered for. That's one option. And that's more important than the Labour Party. The Labour Party is slowly moving. So it's now in favour of the customs union. It will not penalise the 6 million people. The Labour Party still carries echoes of the thinking from the 1970s referendum. And in the 1970s, Britain was the second most equal country in Europe. Sweden, large country, Sweden was more equal, but we were actually not doing that badly. And in the 1970s, you could make a very good argument that said, you don't want to join this bunch of capitalist, nasty, business-led, undemocratic people. You know, you might as well do it on your own. And a bit of that thinking still survives in the Labour Party. What I would say to people who think that, they haven't realised that we've gone from being a country which was pretty equal, where people live for longer in Sheffield than the average life expectancy, to one of the very worst countries of Europe. So Europe, for all its faults, is more cosmopolitan, egalitarian and fair than we are. And I think you're still getting that battle within the Labour Party. So if you just look at the last 2 days of the Labour Party, I'm not a party member, by the way, of any party, but my family have always been Labour. The last 2 days are quite incredible. People are being deselected who are essentially so right-wing they really would never have been in the Labour Party normally. That's happening. It's happening in London. The attacks on Jeremy Corbyn are back up again at this rate, for suggesting that we might wait for the evidence before trying to work out whether Russia really has poisoned somebody, meaning they can never do a spy exchange again. If the Russian states have actually killed this man, if he dies, how do you do a prisoner swap again? Anyway, but just casting doubt. I promise my other answers will be shorter. But I think it's the internal dissent inside the Labour Party. I think it's actually that. There are people who would like to do socialism in one country, we leave unsullied, back up our industries. And there are people who want to welcome other Europeans. And it's actually that division is pretty strong. So when Corbyn said he was 70% in favour of May, he was being truthful. The man is remarkably truthful. He's just not very good at the kind of lies you need to do to make yourself more popular. I promise I'll keep next answer really short.
I'm not going to be very helpful here, because unfortunately I can't remember the full details, but you may have been aware of a study which came out within the last year, I think, where these academics had mapped every constituency in Britain, or possibly even England, or I think it was England actually, and they'd gone right back to the days of the English Civil War and the parliamentarians versus royalists. Does this ring any bells?
Yeah, go on.
And what they basically found was that an awful lot of areas, you know, particularly Middle England, nothing had changed. And they were mapping this in terms of, I can't remember whether it was mainly or whether it was Tories versus Labour, but what they were basically saying was, you know, actually, things really don't change over hundreds of years. I just wonder what you thought of that, whether you knew of that study and what your response was. Okay.
Well, things change in some places. So London changes dramatically.
Yeah.
Oxford, where I was born and grew up in, and went back to recently, it's stunning. You know, I'm hardly anybody's a local. So there are places that change. There are places which don't. The Tyne Valley up in Newcastle changes incredibly slowly, and in fact the only immigrant group there ever were Irish, and that was the one, and then nobody else came. So I think some places change faster than others. You know, tell you the time value. But rural England has changed. And it's rural and middle England has changed. So it's, I mean, just sort of think about the car or the arrival of electricity or gas. In the 1960s, there wasn't gas or electricity in many rural areas, not to China. There's a novel, I did promise to keep my answers. If you put on more hands, I'll be shorter. There's a novel called From Larkwise to Candleford about the part of the county of Oxfordshire just north of me. It's a novel about poverty, rural poverty in the past. If you try and buy a house there now, because it's on Junction 9 of the M40, you can't. So these rural areas, and Tewkesbury has changed, the kind of people can afford. So in Tewkesbury, people are there, but they've chosen to be there. They've done well in Bristol or well somewhere else in Birmingham. And they've managed to get a house, and the house is worth £300,000, £400,000. They've got grandchildren, and they're partly voting to leave because their grandchildren won't be able to get a mortgage or have a house in the future. But they changed Tewkesbury by turning up with their money in a place like that, in the south of England. So it varies. I mean, Manchester and Liverpool are more cosmopolitan and open. Sadly, and I spent 10 years living in Sheffield, 3 or 4 years in Leeds, you cross the Pennines and a little bit less open. And it's almost certainly just distance from Ireland. More people turned up from Ireland into Manchester and Liverpool, and that's had a long-lasting legacy.
What's the relationship between Leave and Remain in terms of housing tenure, given the huge rise in the private rented sector over the last 20 years?
Everything is confounded by age. So the problem is, tenure is so much age. You can predict your tenure largely from your age. If you're very old, you might still be in secured private renting. So the problem is, it is people who own outright and people with a mortgage are more likely to vote to leave because they're older. People renting privately, despite the fact they should be absolutely livid, because the private rent is twice a mortgage for the exactly same property, they voted to remain because they're young. So that age gap was there. But the interesting thing is that the old were actually voting for the young too. So it isn't that old people voted leave for themselves. They didn't know they weren't going to be around for much longer. When you ask them, why do you vote to leave, it's all for the children and the grandchildren, the legacy, what kind of country you're going to be bequeathing onwards.
What about the new landlord class?
Well, they're tiny. So Shelter once estimated that only 2% of people are landlords. Once you take out the accidental landlords, that is somebody who just one property and never meant to become a landlord, you're looking at a minuscule number of people are landlords. This is partly why, it started with George Osborne and Philip Hammond's carried it on, landlords are being taxed at a higher rate now by the Conservatives because there's so few of them and they've got no political party to go to. So that it isn't, it's very skewed. A small number of landlords own 6, 20, 50, 250 properties. So the average tenant lives in a property owned by a landlord who owns many, many. But from the point of view of the average landlord, they're somebody struggling with one or two properties who say how hard it is to be a landlord. I don't want to annoy you. There'll be somebody in this room who's a landlord. They say it's terrible. There are gaps. They don't always pay their rent. So I've got to fix the boiler, they damage things, tenants are awful. And the answer to that with landlords is, don't be a landlord. It's like you wouldn't try and set up your own school, apart from free schools, or your own hospital, you know. Being a landlord is a complicated thing. But I do feel sorry but it's small. It's small because most of the rented accommodation is owned by landlords who own an enormous amount. Those people down in Kent who bought entire council estates. Yeah.
It's sort of been implicit in what you said around the ideology of Brexit and kind of national identities and personal identities and so on, a lot of those things being in flux. I was wondering whether there was any analysis done of media consumption as against the vote, because that, irrespective of the decline in the dailies, that still seems to be a major factor in influencing those particular elements of it.
There has been some. Again, the problem is the confounding is enormous, because older people tend to read the Mail and Telegraph. You know, this paper is owned by people who are avoiding paying tax, who definitely don't. You've got to remember how scary a proper Europe is. You know, an actual united Europe with a democratic parliament, imagine if that happened. And you're somebody who's got loads of, you know, you live on a Channel Island, you've got loads of money hidden outside the European community. You really want to stop this happening. So that's going on. The other side of the media is the BBC was sure that Remain was going to win. They were also sure that Leave would try to get another referendum and would claim it's unfair. So the BBC went out of their way to present the Leave side. And they only had one economist called Patrick, who had to go on all the time for Leave, because every other economist was Remain. But the BBC went slightly overboard, in hindsight, with trying to appear fair, because, and if you remember Nigel Farage just saying, on the night, we haven't won. He wasn't lying, it wasn't to do with some dodgy investments, although they did spike. You know, the assumption was that you wouldn't win this the first time. But then what you would say is, after Leave had lost with, say, 45% of the vote, every bad news story after the referendum would be, well, if only we'd left European Union, it would all be so much better, until you get another referendum. Lady at the back?
Yeah, I'm just going to say, first of all, I haven't heard a leader talk less publicly than Jeremy Corbyn. You never hear his voice heard at any time. Secondly, the European problem trees may up. So is that not key to the whole Brexit? Brexit's very interesting from a society point of view. But Brexit as an issue, I think, to be honest with you, the European problem up trees may.
Yes.
And if she's key, then the European are key. Brexit's really interesting regarding immigration and fear and mortgages and all those other societal issues. But really, if they're the European trees may, or holding everybody else
up. Yeah. Corbyn says an awful lot.
Different things there, sorry.
Yeah, Corbyn says far, far too much. You don't hear his voice, no. I was once standing on a fire engine in Parliament Square, this was a year ago, stopping the press getting on the fire engine so that the BBC and Sky could get a clear view of Corbyn doing a speech that could have been a Martin Luther King speech. And Corbyn starts off, I think it was quite good and quite inspiring, and Parliament Square was absolutely packed, and the fire engine, which the fire brigade union owned, was rocking slightly with the number of the people, and I was being a bouncer. And Corbyn started off quite well, and then he didn't sum up. He went on and on and on and on. Now, he's got much better. He's done 180 enormous public rallies. Right? And the wonderful thing is anybody can learn to speak publicly with enough practice. But he does speak. In the election campaign, they were forced to report him. So that you saw him for those weeks, because the BBC by law had to do it.
There would be a certain amount of time where you'd have to hear his voice.
Yeah. And since then you don't. It's not just him. Owen Jones hasn't been on various BBC programmes for 9 months. I have been invited once in the last 12 months to the Today programme.
So that's propaganda then?
Well, the Today programme now, Sarah Sands, who used to run The Standard, produces it. The Standard, if you listen to the Today programme now, it is a mild-mannered Conservative councillor versus a right-wing Conservative councillor arguing about housing in the south of England. The BBC are very scared they're going to be privatised.
And so against the BBC, they're just talking about general media.
Yeah. But there isn't a media that will, you've just got The Guardian. Really, and even they don't like Jeremy Corbyn. So it's we're a very strange country. DUP, I should have said, I ought to say. I mean, this basically is a May Foster government. And we ought to say that this is just like Clegg and Cameron. And it's funny that I don't feel brave enough to say it, but that is it is a coalition. It is a coalition government. And that.
Maybe you're aggressive, isn't that?
over
the
what?
The Irish entry that could go into House of Parliament and actually just spread Brexit. The other debates are really, really important and vital for society.
Yeah.
But for Brexit.
For Brexit, for why we might get a hard Brexit at the end of the day is possibly key. It depends how far forward the DUP look. Because. But if the DUP do this, and they might well do it. I mean, if you want to get to United Ireland, this is the right way to do it. And the irony might be it's the DUP that helps you get one by being so bloody minded. I mean, this may sound ridiculous, but imagine me talking 10 years ago and saying it's possible to Scotland to actually get an independence referendum. I mean, we've really got ourselves into a situation now where we were telling the Scots, don't vote to be independent because you really want to be tied to this strong economic thing that we are. You know, if you're trying to get Scotland to go for independence, this was the way to do it. These things aren't planned. But try to imagine without the DUP, imagine if Theresa got an extra 5 MPs that night, so she could do it without them. Even then, she has the most split Conservative Party on the issue that the boys joined. It's Tory boys, these are my age. Why? Imagine you're a teenager in the early 1980s and there's riots going on in cities and there's a miners strike. Why would you join the Conservative Party as a teenager then? What was it that really mattered to you? And when you ask them, they say things like, it was the European Union, that's why I joined as a teenager. And the Maastricht was a terrible sellout of our basic something or other that mattered to them. They're in there, the Tory boys of my age, this is really, really important to them. Jacob Rees-Mogg, this matters to him even more than abortion. She's got a really split party. They're always about trying to hold it together, the Tory party. But again, silver lining time, political parties don't last forever. You know, if you're trying to engineer what could actually lead to a split in the Tory party, this is the kind of thing to do it. If I'm getting really optimistic, the British class system, right, which is there, class systems don't last forever. You know, what would it take to actually get away from the British class system? It might take a bit of national impoverishment, you know, and a bit of learning and, you know, realising. So I think all kinds of things are possible. I'm deeply worried about the immediate future, which is why I've decided I'm a monarchist. But which is sounds ridiculous, but I am. Go on, somebody had their hand up.
I'm curious. I'm not terribly versed in this, so I'm going to ask a very basic and obvious question. The majority of people in Northern Ireland voted to remain.
Yes.
And I'm wondering about that profiling, because in Northern Ireland you tend to see the DUP is quite reactionary, and, you know, propping May up and all that. So I'm wondering, have you looked at the distribution of the voting in Northern Ireland? Because it seems to go across the most unexpected. Mm. It goes from Republicans right across to sort of moderate unionism and working class. And I wondered what that profile was telling you about Northern Ireland.
Yeah, if you got very good eyesight.
Yeah, I wasn't able to see that one.
Yeah, but also you've got to remember we've made Belfast so really
big. I asked you to comment.
I haven't looked because the scope for an English academic to get things on in the UK is bigger here than anywhere else. So I haven't looked, but the fact we have two countries that solidly voted for May in such, you know, Scotland and Northern Ireland.
Yes.
Unequivocal. Much stronger votes for Remain in these two countries than the actual votes for Leave in the other two is really going to heat things up. Wales is fascinating. You know, why did Wales vote to leave? One thing people forget about Wales is it's full of English people. In demographics, it's actually called the elephant's graveyard of England. It's where if you sell your house in a medium to even slightly better part of Birmingham, it's where you go to retire to. And it has a Western Daily Mail, so it has its own special Daily Mail that's even more reactionary than the Daily Mail. The biggest immigrant groups in Britain are the English in Scotland and in Wales. They disrupt systems. They buy houses so locals can't afford them. Their elderly, they don't contribute because they're retired to society. But when people say, you know, why do the Welsh vote to leave when Europe gives so much money to the valleys? The areas that voted Leave include very large numbers of elderly retired English people, including English people who wanted to get away from Birmingham to somewhere where everybody was white. Well, not can't remember Bush, but I don't think we should be so surprised at the Welsh vote. The mistake is of thinking of it as a Welsh vote and not realising it's different. At the back. Shout out, please.
Sorry, I'm not totally sure what my question is, but I agree with you that it looks as if we're heading for Scotland to have independence and potentially for Ireland being reunited in whatever time scale we're looking at because of Brexit. So, but how do you marry the kind of rise of English nationalism with Empire 2.0? That, yeah. Are they willing to cast us off to achieve Empire 2.0, basically? Because it seems like unionism has died.
Yeah. Oh, in England, you didn't.
In England,
right.
Yeah.
I'm sure some people in England have an almost religious belief in it. But there's so many things going on that they didn't realise. I mean, going right back, the Act of Union 1703 was an act of convenience. We were just beginning, our pirates were beginning to work out how to get gold off the Spanish ships. We only came that part. I'm not going to put my foot over saying what happened over here. But that part was somebody actually got to agree rather than being forced. Right, the Act of Union for Scotland. It was only worth having a union because we were becoming richer. And then when we got an empire, it was great having that from the point of view of Scotland and England. And Scotland and England took part in that empire pretty equally, Scottish engineers around the world. Once that empire's well and truly gone, when you're down to the last half or less of the oil, and you notice the English draw a line that goes diagonally into the North Sea, it's an incredible line, claiming it is ours. It's not going to wash. And once the magic of the City of London begins to disappear, it doesn't make sense to want to be governed from Westminster. And you are governed from Westminster until you can set your own taxes and control your own border. The idea of the sacred union, right? I hold the Mackinder chair at Oxford. Halford Mackinder was a Conservative and Unionist MP who had a seat in Glasgow, and this is 100 years ago. This really mattered to him. He was born in Lincolnshire, but the union was incredibly important because it was the sacred space at the centre of a world island that was going to control the world. That kind of thinking from English people born in Lincolnshire, I think, is kind of going nowadays. And you've got to say, and I read these things, you know, why did Halford Mackinder think that the British people were superior and should control the entire planet? Well, in his parents' lifetime, we discovered evolution and the world was changing so fast. You know, it must have been an incredible time of changing thought. That legacy is still there. If you look at the rich families of Britain, look at Cameron's family, look at where the money comes from. You go stockbroker, and I won't libel myself over what the other. It's trickling down from empire. Look at Osborne's. It wasn't just wallpaper. For well-off families, their great-great-grandparents were the wealthiest people on the planet. They were the equivalent of the people who own Amazon and Facebook today. You know, that was great-great-granddaddy. Your grandmother talked about having Christmas there. Can you imagine what it must feel like from one of those families? This kind of sinking down of Britain. You know, and I think if you're trying to work out what is the impetus of some of the people with the money, you know, who gives 600 or a million pounds for Leave? I think some of that's there. There's a question just there.
I know this would be pretty much impossible, but I think it might be a good idea to just dissolve all the governments and start it over again.
Dissolve and start
it over.
It's a good question about the wealth. I mean, this partly demonstrates that things don't work or don't work and work as well as you think, but in the mainland of Europe, we still actually haven't got to a form of democracy yet. So we actually don't have a government. Parliament doesn't have control. Council of Ministers and other pretty undemocratic things, and something called the semester that's really worth looking up, which is basically the leaders of countries have incredible control. So we haven't tried government on the mainland. And we're remarkably undemocratic here. So I was in a debate last week about democracy. We were saying, you know, mother of parliament, most democratic place. You know, we still have a first-past-the-post system, whereas most democratic countries, your vote actually counts. America's even worse, but that's not saying very much. So I wouldn't dismiss. Somebody else had their...
You predicted that having less conservative MPs in Brussels, that might be in their own run something good in European Union. Yeah. Probably you alluded to the possibility of social reform and having a social euro. That prediction brought a smile in my face. But I was wondering, where do you base that optimistic prediction, especially taking into account that the founding principles of the European Union were principles to promote a market union, to promote the interests of the capital. And as you said in your last answer, especially now, neoliberalism is much more entrenched in the policies of Brussels through the new European Economic Government. See the semester, see the six-pack policies that we have that really promote totally undemocratic policies and remove democracy from each country and then transfer it to transnational making bodies. And also taking into account the harm that has been done by neoliberal policies promoted from Brussels to countries like Greece and a lot of other Central European countries, which of course don't have as big an economy as England.
Yeah. I can see, particularly from Greece, your point. I'd say watch what happens with Greece in the next few years in particular, in that I think Britain leaving has changed the attitude of some people in Germany to Greece and to the idea of solidarity in Europe. Before Britain voted to leave, you could treat people inside the European Union pretty badly, thinking they're forced to stay, they won't go anywhere else. Once you've had a country leave, you can't do that. Also, all the complaints come out. So we now know far more about the European Union after the vote, not before the vote. We didn't know any of this before we voted. But after the vote, people in Britain and people elsewhere know far more. People in Greece know far more than they ever knew. You know, the EU flag is everywhere in Greece, as it is everywhere in the mainland. It's just not flown in Britain that much. The pressure to reform the institutions of Europe will be incredibly high, higher than it was before. Now you may say, we can't possibly do it, it's too large, you can't do it. But there are examples in the rest of the world of something near this large where it's done. My view about what happened to Greece is it's similar to what the Conservative government in the 1980s did to Liverpool. Very similar, except that Liverpool was part of the same country. But that kind of...
Discipline
and do that. Neoliberalism is an experiment that's been tried for 30 years. A lot of lessons have already been learned. They're obvious. You know, theoretically, it might have made us all better off and rich and happy and so on. But having played out the experiment, anybody who's sensible and sane, you know, will have already worked it out. Some people take longer than others. But it's in that context that I think you could be optimistic without, I'll call them headbangers, but the kind of, you know, British politicians were pretty vapid, you know, over what we were willing to allow to happen. We currently have infant mortality rise in this country. Do they care? Do they mention it? Nowhere else in Europe. Britain is now 19th in Europe. For infant mortality. Only a couple of countries that are worse than us. We have no Greece, infant mortality is better, Greece life expectancy is better. Greece now, there are 2 years where it didn't, Greece is spending more per head on its health service than we are, and people can't get cancer treatment in Greece. Greece is spending more. It's unbelievable how bad this country is. But we're so proud and British that we don't recognise. So things are terrible in Greece, but more people are dying younger here than in Greece, despite everything that's happened in Greece. Yes?
I'm trying to get some clarity about your thesis. I think what you're observing, especially within the rise of English nationalism, it's what we're witnessing is Brexit is a symptom of a kind of a post-imperial stress disorder within the English political system. But to what extent is that over-determining and leading to a certain delusion around the objective class interest in Empire 2.0? You know, there must be an objective class interest there somewhere in leaving the Union. And it's obviously framed and overdetermined by this, the collapse of the imperial imaginary within the English system as well.
Yeah. I wouldn't call it a thesis. I'm struggling around in the dark, honestly. And that's why I've only published one thing. Because this is what's fascinating about this is how it is not obvious and it is not complicated. English nationalism, that graph going round and round again, there isn't evidence of a slow and steady rise. There is something that can be stoked up, but thankfully it's not so slow and steady. Across the whole of Europe, the New York Times has this wonderful graph that they keep on updating about right-wing voting. It's actually gone down in the last 5 years. Nobody ever puts a headline that. And there are whole countries which don't have right-wing parties. But there isn't an overall rise in right-wing voting. What happens is, as soon as the AfD gets more votes in Germany, we say this is terrible. Or something happens in Vienna, we say it's terrible. We don't report all the stories of the voting falling. So the overall rise of nationalism populism in Europe is not there. It's just as a want, particularly by British journalists, to spot it in Italy and so on, to kind of make ourselves feel better. The class interest, I think, is international money now. It's the way you make your money now is you invest in a mobile phone company on the far west of China and have the signals there. The money, you have people who go to meetings in Hong Kong and they agree something. You make your money from around the planet. You need somewhere safe to put it, and you need a family home. And the world is increasingly precarious outside, and you might lose your money. London is a safe place. It believes in the rules of property, the class interest. You can have your family home, 5 or 10 million in London, and you can keep your money in a former British colony somewhere else that the Privy Council will look after the interests of it. And that's the class interest in this. And because you believe that capitalism is the best thing that ever happened on the planet and it's taken more people out of poverty than anything else, you are the good guy. And because you're stopping the evil tax people taking your money, you're helping bring in even more people out of poverty in future. So it's your civic duty to be greedy. And they believe this. They don't wake up in the morning thinking, I'm a bit of a nasty person, but I want more money. They wake up believing that they are special, genetically superior to most of us in this room, and only their entrepreneurial spirit will make that special vacuum cleaner that the world needs to build in Malaysia and you want to have. That, I think that's what's going on with. So certainly a class interest with international money.
But I was wondering about the relationship with the collapse of the imperial imaginary that's going along with this. Is there a, how do they interact, that class interest and the delusion around being able to build a new imperial economy of some kind?
Oh, the 2.0
delusion.
And that delusion is widespread. You've got to remember George Osborne, 2015. George Osborne said by 2030, if you follow the economic plan, we will be the richest country per capita on Earth by 2030. George, who's not one of the Yeah, believe him. I was on Newsnight with Matthew Hancock, who was his lackey at the time. And there's a clip, because if you want to see what I look like if I'm about to hit somebody, that's what my wife said. She said, I thought I hit my wife. My wife said, you were about to lose it. There's a clip of me on Newsnight, opposite Matthew Hancock, just saying, there is no way that Britain can do this in 15 years. But Osborne believed it. And he's fairly central. So I do think occasionally young Conservatives from a particular college in Oxford come and knock on my door. And they come and knock on my door because I live in East Oxford, which is a very solid Labour area. And they're training. You know, they're not going to win a councillor, but it's a kind of training thing for young Conservatives in Oxford. And they knock on my door and I say to them, sorry, my family are Labour, but I say to them, you really should switch to the Liberal Party if you want a future. You know, I'm not going to ask them to go all the way to Labour. But for their own good, for their own sake, it's a silly thing to teach yourself to when you're 18 or 19. And I try to be nice to them, and they think I'm a... The street I live in was built for college servants, so they think I'm down there. And in some ways I am down there. I don't have the wealth that their families have. But when you get talking to them, and the longer I talk to them, the less effect they might have elsewhere, so it's worth talking always. The longer I talk to them, the more the importance of Britain and the patriotism comes out from them. And this is something they believed in. And when they were in their little school, when they couldn't go and meet other children because those children go to state schools, and they grew up in this very strange childhood. When they were growing up in this and reading whatever books they read, they have become wedded to the idea of greatness. And it's also in them. Their family have invested, sacrificed a lot for them to have a privileged education. They're coming to an elite university where it only makes sense that we have an elite university with tutorials of 1-to-1 and 1-to-2. If there's something special about them, and they're going to go on to do something good for all of us. And they're not cynical. They deeply believe, and these are teenagers, 18, 19-year-old Oxford University students. Yeah, to go knocking on a Sunday morning on the other side of town, they're driven by an ideology. And because it's not, there's not an ounce of this in my body, that is why I'm fascinated by it. And you can begin to ask questions about where do people's motivations come from and so on. Should we just do another one question? Two? Lady at the back again, then we do one last one.
Yeah, I've got a couple of time. Yeah. Do you think Brexit's my death it won't happen then?
I don't think it will be stopped by Theresa. I think that's wishful thinking. I don't think she's got it in her, but it would be quite incredible. I don't think we're going to have a second referendum. I don't think the House of Lords are going to manage to get that through. I just think that's slightly insulting and dangerous as well. It actually end up with a bigger Leave vote. You've got to remember, Leave have all the money. It's possible that British business gets together and works out just how disastrous it is for most of it. And it's possible on a class basis that although Brexit's in the interest of the top 0.1%, you've got international money, it's not in the interest of the other 9/10 of the 1%. The question is whether the other 9/10 of the 1% can get together to stop it. And I suspect they won't. But I think that's the kind of game we're playing. The other thing to say about Brexit is we had a really, really unfair deal. Because of what Margaret Thatcher negotiated, we were not paying our fair share in. And a lot of people on the mainland are quite angry about that. So by leaving, we end that unfair deal. But the most unfair deal wasn't that, but we weren't billions we don't pay because we have opt-out. The most unfair deal was the demographic detail. Nowhere else in Europe was taking young, highly educated people who'd been brought up in another country. Another country had paid for them, school and university. And we were taking them in and getting them to change beds in hotels and sort of everything else. And then we went and exported our elderly to die over there. Cameron's father, Clegg's father, they both died in France. Right? And the actual cost of that, if you monetize that, the migration, It was really, really unfair.
Or people moved to Scotland or Wales for more space.
Yeah, more space. But you know, part of me does think this is going to end part of that unfairness. You know, we had skillfully negotiated ourselves quite a good deal, and a deal which was to the detriment of people in the rest of the mainland, particularly losing their kids so often to come here. And let alone, you come from the European Union to one of our universities, and we're going to make you pay £9,000 a year for it. But we were spreading across Europe the idea that it was okay to charge children to go to university. I mean, big countries were resisting it. In Germany, nobody pays. Nobody from anywhere in the world pays. But we were infecting Europe with the idea, privatise your health services, privatise your train services, make children pay to go to school and university. We were really dangerous. And the Brexit vote, which I didn't vote for, may be one of the fastest ways to inoculate the mainland of Europe from the really bad ideas that we were spreading. And you say, you know, I agree the EU is a capitalist kind of club, but we are far worse than that. So I think they've really shot themselves in the foot in a way. The worry is, what the hell happens to us in the next 24 months? But we've got a royal wedding. So smile. Okay. Okay, John. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tommy. Just to plug some events coming up for the rest of the festival. We finish tomorrow, but we've got something like 15 events still to come. Tonight we've got a polemical poetry evening. You're very welcome in this theatre. And tomorrow we've got a whole range of events, everything from looking at the legacy of World War I to Jarliff Regan and the Black Box, all sorts of varied acts and talks and debates that hopefully you'll enjoy. So thank you very much for coming, and thanks again to Danny for sharing such an inspiring talk. Thank you.